everyone, and welcome to the Facing Up podcast. I'm Luke Grenfell-Shaw. Now, today, I'm super excited. I'm generally super excited when I'm doing these podcasts, but particularly today, I'm talking with Lucy Gossage, who I first came across when I was like a teenager triathlete, older teens, just getting into triathlon, and I kind of came across Lucy in, you know, the pages online of, like, you know, 220 triathlon, thinking this was like a cool person who kind of combined PhD at Cambridge with like high level triathlon. I was like, oh, she's pretty cool. It's bizarre the twists that life takes you on, because now not only are we chatting, but I feel very honored to say that you're a friend.
Absolutely.
So it's amazing just to be having this conversation. For some, Lucy will need no introduction. For others, it's perhaps worth saying she's a 12-time Ironman champion. But much more than that, she's also an oncologist working in Nottingham
and the founder of 5K Your Way, which I think is just the most incredible organization for people with cancer, which I'm really looking forward to talking about later.
And she has so many bikes. I've seen them, and I thought I had a lot of bikes. I don't. Lucy, thanks for coming and joining Facing Up.
Oh, it's always fun chatting with you, Luke.
Yeah, and I always really enjoy it. So it's mutual. So I thought we could talk about, there's kind of a few different things that came to my mind about kind of how I wanted to pick your brains about challenges that you've faced and maybe opportunities that have kind of tied in with them. And I kind of see those perhaps the challenges of being a pro triathlete, or perhaps no longer being a pro triathlete, challenges of being an oncologist, and then sort of something a bit more topical to now, thinking about the challenges that COVID has presented us as a nation and you particularly as a doctor. So to start with, what was the greatest challenge of being a pro triathlete?
The greatest challenge was actually, well, there were two. One was asking for my pro license, and the other, and I think this was the biggest challenge, was asking to go part-time at work. And the reasons they were so hard was, I think firstly, by asking to go part-time, I was admitting to myself that I thought I was good enough to justify going part-time. And there was an enormous part of me that just thought everyone would laugh at me. I'd applied for this job in Cambridge. I was working in Cambridge. I was doing a PhD. The guy who'd employed me was this very, very academic, non-sporty guy. I felt that I was letting him down. He was actually unbelievably supportive. I think the biggest challenge was admitting to myself that I thought I was good enough to justify it. Go and ride my bike around the world.
Yeah, which sounds awesome. But was there a moment that you either realised you were going to commit to it, or something that pushed you into doing it? Or was there a moment that you decided to take on the challenge and say, yeah, I'm bam, doing it?
No, so I think I got good at triathlon when I moved to Cambridge to do a PhD. So I started triathlon when I was an oncology registrar, so trainee doctor. And then I moved to Cambridge to do this PhD, and it was moving for all the wrong reasons. It was moving to a place because it was prestigious on paper. It was moving because I could, not because I wanted to. And then I got there and I absolutely hated the first year. I was ignored by my boss, not the guy that I just mentioned, by someone else. And I was in a lab. I wasn't seeing patients. So I didn't really have any job satisfaction. I didn't have any purpose from what I was doing. And so I think that was when I started to train rather than exercise. And then over the kind of first couple of years of the PhD, I started to get quite good and did well as an age grouper. And then I think the decision to race professional was relatively easy, because it was a case of I could do very well as an age grouper and have quite an easy life, or I could challenge myself and come last, which is what I thought would happen, but you know, and not do so well, but be racing much better people and get the best out of myself. So that was quite a relatively an easier decision, I think.
It's really interesting when you're saying going back to the reasons why you moved to Cambridge. And I think this could be said for a number of like prestigious universities and indeed sort of doing PhDs in themselves. It's something I've struggled with, of this idea of reaching the pinnacle. This is how I see it, at least, or how I saw it, of, you know, it's somehow reaching the pinnacle of academia. And that's kind of like the ultimate intellectual confirmation. And maybe I'm just speaking, you know, from my own insecurities here, but there's definitely something I felt of like how it's something I now think about a lot more, and how important it is to do things that we really want to do them ourselves, rather than these other, the status, the prestige, the how society might perceive us if we've got that PhD, etc.
So I think that's one of the biggest things that triathlon's taught me, and it's it's quite interesting. When I went to ask my boss if I could go part time, I was so worried about it, and I sent him an email on the Friday, like, you know, Friday evening. I knew that he'd see it, but and I'd arranged a meeting with him on the Monday, because I knew if I just did it face to face, I'd just go, oh, I'm not very good at this. But I put a very coherent email together and put my points as to why I wanted to do it and why I thought it was worthwhile. And I was, one of the things I was saying was that I thought it would make me a better doctor. And honestly, I thought they were empty words when I was writing them. I didn't really think it would make me a better doctor.
The BS sensor kind of started twitching quite a bit.
But it so has. And I think one of the biggest things it's taught me is not to do things just because you can, but to do things because you really want to. And I moved to Cambridge because I was good enough to, you know, I'd been an undergrad there, and it wasn't about going to Cambridge, but on paper, I moved there because I could, and I didn't have any other reason to do it other than that I could go there. And now I would never make a decision for that reason. And I, you know, I always kind of think, when it comes to the big decisions in life, if you're not thinking, you know, yes, I really want to do it, then probably the answer's no. And and I think that's such a valuable life lesson. And it has, it's changed my whole career, because I'm now working full time temporarily, but I work part time. I do a job that I really love. I'm not just climbing the career ladder to get to the top. I'm climbing a ladder that I want to be climbing. And that's such a valuable lesson that I would never have had without triathlon.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you've come through that, to learning that lesson through triathlon. And I feel like my cancer diagnosis has kind of really opened my eyes up to it, because I think actually has led to this podcast, amongst other things. I, you know, was good at science, I'm sure, like, you know, like you at school, and therefore I thought, right, so I'm a scientist. And so I did biology, you know, and then I was thinking of biology PhDs and plant science, and because I was good at it and because I thought this is important. But what I found is I love hearing people's stories, and and it's actually was very difficult for me, and I'm still accepting that as actually, like, that's legitimate. Like, that doesn't mean I'm kind of intellectually lazy to be doing this. Maybe that sounds very odd to
my PhD was on it was related to kidney cancer. It was on the VHL gene. It was such basic science. There was zero passion, and I've never minded staying late at work. You know, sometimes you think, I wanted to get out on my bike, and you resent a bit. But fundamentally, I've never ever resented working hard in the hospital, because I'm passionate about it. And I never, as a triathlete, like, I did some crazy sessions, some horrible things. I made so many sacrifices. I missed weddings, I missed parties, I missed dinners out, I missed family get-togethers. But I didn't resent any of it, because I was passionate about it. Whereas in my PhD, when I had to go into the lab on a Saturday or on Christmas Eve to feed my cells, or I'd resent every single minute of a weekend or a sunny day that I was spending in the lab, because I had no passion for it. And that's such a valuable lesson.
Do you know why you finished the PhD?
Why did I finish it? I nearly always finish something I started. I felt like I was funded by Cancer Research UK. I owed it to them to finish it. I think when I went part time, I owed it to my supervisors. And actually, one of the best feedback, one of the nicest comments I got from him was how much better it went, or how much how much, oh, I'm not sure what, I can't remember his words. But anyway, basically my PhD went a lot better when I went part-time because I had the balance and I didn't resent it. And I'm glad I did finish it because the best bit of the PhD in terms of my learning, but also, you know, producing something that's valuable was in the final year, which is what a lot of people say. Yeah, I'm proud. I've never not finished a race, and there's no way I wasn't going to finish my PhD. But and I think that's another lesson, isn't it? Like, I've always known I'm stubborn and persistent, but just because you're not enjoying something doesn't mean that you should quit it. I guess you just need to make sure you're finishing it for the right reasons. Yeah, I would have had lots of guilt if I'd not finished it. I would have felt that I would have wasted the time that I'd put into it so far. I did need it for my career in terms of jobs and things. And I think it says a lot about someone as well if you give up just because something's not going as well as you want it to at the start.
I think that's really interesting, and I definitely would have wholeheartedly agreed with you until quite recently. But now I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm more like, because time is precious, you know, doing something that really isn't fulfilling and just completing something which is utterly unfulfilling for the sake of completing it, I'm now much more self-critical about, you know, self-aware about why I would be doing that. I can't think of an example off the top of my head.
But I would say it wasn't unfulfilling. So the first year was indescribably hard and I hated it. The second year was a bit better. I know it ended up taking me 5 years because I went part-time. But actually, the 2.5 years when I was working part-time, I kind of enjoyed it because it was very flexible. It was the best. I had complete drive over what I was doing. I'd evolved the project away from protein science into something that was much closer to patients and more relevant. And I was racing professionally at the same time. So that actually the last 2.5 years, I really enjoyed it. And I also kind of saw the PhD as much more than just the papers that I produced. And I think the way that it's changed me, and I have a lot of guilt because it was a huge amount of Cancer Research UK's funding. But, you know, you don't fund someone expecting to cure cancer. It's a tiny little bit of the jigsaw. But I think a lot of the learnings that I made from the PhD are letting me do different stuff with my career. So I'm in lots of ways, I'm very grateful for that horrendous first year because I'd certainly never become a professional triathlete and I'd never come off the career ladder had I not had that horrendous first year.
Yeah. I really want to ask as well, like, was it difficult changing your identity, or did you feel like you're changing your identity, or was that actually one of the easiest bits?
In what sense?
Going from a doctor and a PhD student into a full-time triathlete, or, you know, full-time triathlete, part-time PhD student to full-time triathlete. Was that difficult as an identity shift?
I found it hard going to do my PhD because as a doctor, as I was a registrar, which, you know, you're a relatively senior doctor. You're making decisions not independently, but you will often, you know, do a lot of stuff with patients on your own. And I felt I was useful. And every day, no matter how bad it was or whatever had happened, you'd go home and you'd know you'd been useful. Whereas in the PhD, and that's why I started to train, because I'd get to the end of the week, I'd be like, what have I achieved? I've achieved nothing and I haven't even enjoyed it. It's all right achieving nothing if you've enjoyed it. And then that's why I started to train. So I think that transition was probably harder. The becoming a professional athlete, not really, because I never really felt like a professional triathlete. And B, I set out to do it for 1 year. So I only had 2.5 years full time, but it was only 1 year when, you know, that's what I'd kind of agreed to initially. So I felt like it was a sabbatical, and it wasn't, you know, I always felt like a fraud, and I still do to some extent.
A fraud as a pro triathlete, you mean?
Yeah, I still do. I still look back and, you know, I don't really believe it's me. And certainly at that time when I started to become good and become a bit more recognized, it wasn't me, that wasn't really my identity. My identity was, you know, the Lucy that my friends know, the chopper who's always got oil marks on her legs and never wears matching socks and always falls off a bike and, you know, has all this.
For those not in the know, cycling, those are all horrendous crimes. You know? I feel that needs some contextual data there.
A professional triathlete. I was cycling around with running Minnie Mouse ears on my helmet for about the good part of the year. I felt my identity was a chopper, and I was quite happy with that. You know, I liked being that person who just rocked up and gave it a go, and
a few people on the way. I've got to ask, because I'm sure some people will be wondering, you haven't mentioned the races being hard as a challenge. You know, it's a very different sort of challenge, but what gets you through races? What gets you through that pain and the fatigue or the hard sessions?
So I think races are hard, but if you're in a good mental place, then you're ready. And that was actually sometimes the battle, getting myself in a mental place where I was ready to race really hard. I think the hardest part as a pro is probably when you're injured. And you're training, but you're not really sure why you're training. And I guess that's what a lot of people are going through at the moment with COVID. I think for me, the darkest time as a pro was definitely when I broke my collarbone, and that was 8 weeks before the World Championships. But I knew it was my last World Championships. I was going back to work 2 weeks after. I'd already gone from 1 year to 2 years to 2.5 years. I had to go back to work. And breaking my collarbone at that point felt insurmountable. And actually, you know, I kept trying to tell myself, it's just a collarbone. You know, I'd had a friend who'd had a spinal cord injury. I kept saying, it's not cancer, it's just a blowing collarbone. But that didn't help, telling myself it could be worse. And I think that's quite an interesting lesson as well. But the challenges of racing, I'm quite proud. I never didn't finish. I had lots of bad races. I walked once in Kona.
Many do.
Of course there were tough bits, but I think I'm quite mentally strong. And I think probably looking back now, and I'm a bit more distanced from it, what I'm most proud of from my career is never having not finished. And probably the days where I wasn't winning and I wasn't doing what I wanted to, but I stuck in there. And generally, I like to think that I always was a bad loser, a good loser. You know, I was finished with a smile and was quite gracious. And I think that's what I'm most proud of, probably.
That's very cool. I am intrigued to sort of poke this collarbone a little bit more and just.
You are actually poking your own forehead with something.
Oh, with a pen. Yeah. it's my thinking pen. Yeah, I pull all sorts of weird expressions when I'm probably talking to people and I don't even realise. I put down the pen and now I'm just using my index finger instead. So with the collarbone, you had. It seems like it could have really derailed you, but you actually finished ninth in the end at the World Championships, which was your best result. So somehow you turned this round from like what should have been game over by a lot of people's standards. You know, what was the mental process that you went through to get into the state where you wanted to race again, I suppose?
So I had the crash and I'd actually not that long ago broken up with a boyfriend as well. Maybe I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks after Ironman UK and so it must have been a month. Anyway, there's quite a lot going on, and initially I was devastated. I thought that was it. I thought that was game over, and that my career was just because I didn't realise I'd carry on racing after going back to work. So in my head, all the way through 2016, Kona was the finale of my tri career, and then I was going back to work, and that was it. So initially I was devastated. And this is quite interesting as a doctor, actually, because I went to see a surgeon and he gave me all the information and he basically said, look, I can repair it. You don't need it repairing. It will repair itself. It will take 12 weeks to repair. That you definitely can't raise Kona if you don't have it fixed. If you do have it fixed, you'll probably rip it out going swimming or something. There's absolutely no guarantee that you'll be able to raise Kona. In fact, I don't think you will be able to raise. But anyway, he gave me all the information and then he let me make the decision. And I always thought that patients would want to make their own decisions and be given the information to make their own decision. And I didn't. I wanted him to tell me whether I should have it repaired or not. And I found that so hard because I felt like I didn't know what he was a surgeon. I didn't know what the right answer was. But anyway, I got it fixed. And then I had a few dark weeks where I was kind of going through the motions of, well, I know I was doing a lot of training, but not really believing that I could go. A lot of indoor biking. But it was a blessing in disguise because it took all the pressure off. And I think having gone through that, that was in no small part why I carried on racing when I did go back to work.
Yeah, I guess when you feel like when you've been through a challenge and managed to come out and feel like you've done yourself justice despite the circumstances not being in your favour, that can.
I think three things came out of that. So firstly, firstly that you can race well with inadequate preparation, because if anyone, like, I did a lot of training, but it was so unspecific. So that was one thing. Secondly, I liked being the underdog, and that collarbone took off any pressure. And going back to work in my head would take off any pressure. And thirdly, that I could just really enjoy racing just for the sake of it. And there's no that was my big reason for carrying on. There was no reason to stop.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. Like, the races I've enjoyed most are the ones where I wasn't putting pressure on myself to do well. They're like the ones where you kind of think you're going to get smashed, and if it goes better than that, you're like, oh yeah, I'm up with these guys. Like, go me, you know. Like, and pushing harder because of that, you know, because you're not pushing. Well, I guess because you're not pushing to sort of almost run away from someone. I don't know. My attitude is, you know, when you've got a really big target to sort of attack, I suppose.
Yeah, I think all my best races, I've not been focused on anybody else. I've not been focused on the results. I've just been focused on getting the best out of myself. And generally that means enjoying it as well. And I think that's what I did in Kona. I remember very clearly at one point in the race, I was running along the Queen K, which is the highway, and it must have been about, I don't know, 15 miles into the run. I was just going past too far. I was thinking, I'm going to end up like sixth or something. And then the wheels fell off in the last 10K. So I didn't keep catching it. But I just remember I was just racing. I just couldn't believe what I was doing. And I didn't go in, you know, I came off the bike, I don't know where, 20th or something, but it didn't matter. Whereas in previous years, I might have been like, I'm 20th, I've got to finish in the top 10. And there was just no, that it just, yeah, wasn't even on my radar.
Okay. So I want to take this into a slightly different direction. And actually, when you were talking about you went to the surgeon and said kind of like, you know, what would you recommend? You wanted him to make the decision, it sounded like. I kind of want to talk a little bit more about, I guess, your role as an oncologist, and I guess contrasting that with my position, you know, and I've been a patient. And perhaps if I'd been Nottingham, we'd have met each other. And also in this bit, like, and actually throughout this conversation, I'd love, you know, if you want to challenge me and ask me questions and fire some stuff back, absolutely go for it. But I've been like, really, one of the things that was on my mind was like, what should the patient consultant relationship look like? Who should decide? Who should ask the questions? What should the power dynamic look like?
Mm-hmm.
These are the things that I've kind of wondered about, and I'm really interested in your perspective.
Oh, I think it's really hard. I think for every patient, it's completely different what patients want from their doctor. I do a lot of work with, as you know, I treat sarcomas and germ cell tumours, testicular cancers. So I treat a lot of younger patients. And I find those relationships can be the most challenging. I'll never forget, actually, it's quite an interesting story, but when I started as an oncology registrar in 2006, so a long time ago, shows how long how triathlon has protracted my training. So that's an aside. But I remember about a month into the job, a young lady came in, was admitted with an infection. Her white cells, her infection fighting cells were low. And so I went to see her as the on-call registrar and started doing what I normally do. And then she turned around to me and she said, "You're Harriet's sister, aren't you?" And Harriet's my sister. I was completely taken aback. And she had a very aggressive kidney cancer. And I got to know her really well over the next, I can't remember, a year and a half or something. And then she died, and I found that so hard because it was the first time I'd only just started doing oncology, but it was the first time I'd met someone or worked with someone who in another life might have been a friend, and we'd gone to the same school, and she wasn't friends with my sister, but she knew my sister, and I found creating that divide between the doctor and the patient, because there has to be a divide.
Yeah.
I felt like she wanted to be my friend. You can't be at your patient's friends. You can get to know them. And I think I find it really hard. So there are two of us that treat sarcomas, and I find it really hard if I'm not the first person to meet the patient, because that's the time when you can ask all the interesting questions about what they do in their normal life. You know,
right.
Are they a runner? Are they an actor? You know, you get a picture of the person behind the patient, and it's very hard as a doctor if you walk in 2 weeks down the line. It's very hard to then ask those questions. You can obviously do it, but it's not the same.
So each patient is different. But to sort of return to this first question, I'm not quite happy yet of like, okay,
I've deflected.
You've deflected it very artfully, but okay, to sort of put it in different terms, as when I was a patient myself, and I guess other times when I've seen a doctor, you know, just generally, it can feel like there's a power dynamic in the room because one person appears to know everything. One person kind of can control your fate, as it, you know, it looks like there's this kind of information disparity, it feels like. And I feel that can be quite an intimidating environment to be a patient, right? To turn up to a doctor, you've just been told you've got a life-threatening illness. You're not feeling, you know, positive or perhaps, you know, high in confidence by any stretch. And then you've got this person who appears to have like an encyclopedic
so maybe it goes back to my psychology, but I genuinely feel that I do not have that encyclopedic knowledge, and that quite often patients know far more than I do, and they certainly know more about themselves and their bodies and their blood results, and I'm quite often intimidated by patients who I think know far more, particularly for really rare and uncommon uncommon diseases. But also, you know, we have, I don't know how many patients I treat, but you will have known every single date that you've been in with an infection and how low your white cells went and when you were sick and what days. You've got a better grip of that than I will have seeing you once every 3 weeks or maybe a couple of times when you're an inpatient.
Yeah.
So patients, I don't know, maybe I like to think times have changed, and I think the old kind of paternal doctor-patient relationship has, it should have gone.
Okay, different question. What's the most important thing that you as a consultant can learn from your patient?
Tenacity. I think one of the, there's always a way through something, no matter how hard it is. People always make lemons, like they do, yeah.
Lemons or lemonade?
Lemonade. but I guess, you know, there's generally, and quite often at the start, when you first meet a family, particularly with a younger person, there might be a lot of anger. It might be directed at us, rightly or wrongly, at the system, at the cancer. And then with time, they find a way through it, and that way is very rarely anger. I think I realized the power of the human spirit, because when I think of some of the people that I work with, or I'm even, you know, working with now, I can't imagine being in their shoes and still being able to carry on with life, but they do, and it's not unique. It's unique. It is like every single person does, every single family does, no matter what happens. And I guess when I was reflecting on COVID and how that might change, and I think the whole country went through a very similar process and had 2 weeks of kind of anger and adjustment. And I'm sure that's ongoing for a lot of people, but everyone's finding a way through it.
Okay, you answered that question in a way that I wasn't expecting, but was super interesting. But I still want to ask the counterpart to it, which is sort of like, what is the most important thing that I as a patient can learn from you as an oncologist? Like, what's the most important thing that you can tell me? Do you think there is something?
So I think the most useful thing that we do is to give information to patients and to their families in a way that they can understand, and that level of information would be completely different to you for someone else your age with a different background or different wishes. You know, it's not just education, it's how much they want to know. So we provide that information in a way that they can understand, and then we help them make the decisions regarding treatment that are right for them. And sometimes it'd be very clear cut what the right treatment is, and we would be very strongly recommending that they pursue a certain course of action. Other times it's very much a grey area, and we're weighing up odds and patients are weighing up odds, and that's when what's important to patients is really important. And some patients will choose potential extension of life at any cost, and other patients would choose quality of life, and some people will want us to make those decisions for them, and other people, like I did, which I never thought I would do, and other people will want to make the decisions for themselves, and then you've got the family members as well. So I think all we are really is glorified information givers.
Yeah, I think just trying to, well, you know, when you're saying, you know, so how on earth do you try and balance quality of life over the possibility of having longer? It's a horrible thing to have to look at, like look down the barrel of.
I don't think anyone knows how they would react. And I suspect you didn't, until you got told you had cancer, you probably had no idea how you'd react in that adversity. And
no, perhaps never even thought about it at all.
But perhaps, you know, you might think you'll behave one way if your cancer were to come back. Who knows? I don't know how I'd behave if I got a diagnosis.
I try not to think about it very much right now. So, I was wondering, this is something I feel, this is a very personal question from me, of when I was diagnosed, the outlook seemed incredibly bleak, and I felt I had to create my own hope in that situation. Mm-hmm. I think it probably is surprising most people. I'm still here right now. I feel very, very fortunate to be here right now. But what I want to ask is, how difficult is it for you when giving advice, when giving information, when giving probabilities, when giving potential outcomes, to hit this balance between what I would argue is optimism and realism? Perhaps you actually see it in quite different metrics, but to me, the idea of saying, well, optimism, there's maybe some hope in the situation, look at this bit, versus the realism of perhaps this is very, very serious and your odds are generally, given the statistics that we have, given your profile, are not good. How do you balance that? Or do you see it in different terms?
No, I think it's really hard. And it's, so from a purely practical point of view, it's really hard deciding whether treating someone with treatment that could, you know, in a very small proportion of patients might create a long duration of good quality of life, but equally might kill them. And that's fundamentally what you're weighing up. So you've got a treatment that could potentially, in a small number of patients, do something good. Most patients, it won't do anything, and some patients, it will kill them. And that's really hard. I definitely don't get it right. So we know that if someone is going to die, it's much better if we talk about that earlier, and that's a fact. And we actually know that if you bring up palliative care or enhanced supportive care early, patients not only have better quality of life, but they also live longer. So okay. And that's proven. So I think it's really important to help patients understand if time is limited. We can never put times on things. We can give rough time scales, as in it might be months rather than years, but that's probably as close as you're going to go. But at the same time, you don't need to dwell on that. And if there is a small chance that patients have long-term survival, you can give patients both sides of that, and they can take hold of whatever they want to. I think not, you know, it's hard having conversations about, you know, telling someone that their life expectancy is in all likelihood short. It's much easier to avoid those conversations, but I don't think that does anyone any good, because patients and their families make different decisions. If, you know, look at what you're doing with your life, and you know, your cancer's, who knows where, you know, you're off treatment, you've been off treatment for a long time, who knows, but you're living your life very differently because you've had cancer.
Yeah, I'm not doing a PhD.
Precisely. And it, you know, if I don't know, everyone's different, but we can't make judgments about what patients want to hear. And it's all too easy to judge people based on their background, their demographic, their age, their education level. And when you do that, so often we're wrong.
Interesting.
But it's so hard. It's so hard. And I've got it wrong sometimes. Yeah. Like, I've
human.
It's tough.
Yeah. We've gone quite deep there, and I kind of also, you know, I think it's an incredibly important topic, but it is undoubtedly a difficult topic. One of it, and it's been kind of like, I'm not sure I've had flashbacks as such, but I'm just like, fuck, like, you know, like this, it's because I still feel like I'm in this journey. So, you know, it's sort of,
Which is brave for you to, and most people would not want to talk about this, certainly not publicly on their own podcast.
I don't really know what that says about me, probably.
But what I would say, Luke, is you are offering people hope, and I know that firsthand for some of my patients who are in similar situations to where you were 2 years ago, that, you know, hearing your story and seeing what you're doing is inspiring and is offering hope. And I hear the phrase quite a lot in, you know, people just want to kick the can down the road as long as possible. And actually, you know, if you can find other people who are, I don't know, you're inspiring to lots of people, in part because of what you're doing, but because of what you're doing with your background, I think.
Okay, so on this idea of inspiring and inspiration, which is all about creating change, one of the things that I'm very passionate about is, and one of the things I felt really helped me get through my own treatment was exercise. And I know that, you know, you've put a lot of time into to setting up 5K Your Way, which we'll talk about in hopefully a bit of detail later. But for me, exercise is like such a positive thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it probably changed the outcomes in some way or another of the treatment that I had. There is an increasing amount of research that's coming out highlighting the importance of exercise. But I think it's still really difficult, right? I mean, it's still so difficult if you've had a life-changing diagnosis that you're going to be going through a really unpleasant treatment of chemotherapy, radiotherapy, or surgery. But I guess the question I'm asking, you know, how do you get patients to exercise more? That's the kind of question I'm asking, and the fact that I can't ask it, I'm asking in a very blunt manner, shows that I'm not really coming at it from a very good angle right now. But like, for something that's so powerful, but it's not yet commonplace, I suppose, in cancer treatment.
So I think one of the biggest things we can do as oncologists or anyone working in cancer is actually just give people permission. What often seems to happen is that someone's diagnosed with cancer and whoever loves them wants to wrap that person in cotton wool. And probably based on old wives' tales or what oncologists used to say, they tell that person to rest and they make all their cups of tea and they, no, don't you get up, don't you do the vacuuming. And
breakfast in bed every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I didn't have cancer and I were to lie in my bed every day, being brought breakfast in bed, made my cups of tea, didn't do anything other than get up to go to the bathroom,
then you'd have a great partner.
I would, you know, I'd end up physically a mess and mentally a mess. And so actually, I think for a lot of people, one of the biggest things we can do is just give permission. And I used to do a lung cancer clinic, and it was one of the most rewarding things I'd do is tell patients and their carers that actually it was okay to go out for a walk. And actually it wasn't just okay, it was probably the biggest thing that they could do that would improve the way that they managed their treatment and how they felt and their tiredness levels. And a month later they'd come back in, they'd have been doing their walk every day, and there'd be a new person. And it's like that, that's such a simple thing. So I think number one, give permission.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Number two, we need to encourage it, because the evidence is evolving, but what we know is that it makes people feel better, it makes people less tired, it reduces depressive and anxiety symptoms. But actually there's evolving evidence that it impacts on the cancer's biology as well. And certainly in animal models, it slows growth of cancers, reduces their ability to spread. They've done quite kind of cool experiments where they get people running on a treadmill and then take out their blood, and their blood will then inhibit growth of cancer cells, whereas the people who just take their blood without running, you know, it doesn't do anything.
That's amazing.
So there's accumulating evidence. It's low quality at the moment. It's not there, but I think because of that, we know it makes people feel better, and we know it makes them less tired. If that's all it does, then we should still be telling people about it.
Yes. Yeah. I did a module on aging when I was doing my undergrad, biology undergrad module on aging. And I think the take home from that is very similar to the take home here, that like if exercise was a drug and people could make vast amounts of money from it, like, because you could sell it as a pill, like it would be heralded as the super drug of the millennium. Like it would be the most incredible thing because of its, works on so many different pathways. It has so many complementary effects in different parts of the body. It's clearly a long time ago since I studied biology, but I'm not talking about anymore. But like it's incredibly potent in so many different ways. And usually a drug would just target one tiny part of that pathway. And so I feel it's kind of, maybe it's a sign of the world that we live in, which, that for something to get tested and the money to go into the drug research, all the different trials, if a drug company could make money out of exercise, we'd probably be doing more of it. It would be prescribed. It would have been prescribed earlier, like decades ago, because the research would have been done.
So I've done a few talks at conferences, and I guess there's two points. Firstly, even if all it does is make people feel better, and then that's not a bad thing. Like that if it makes it more manageable to get through cancer treatment, that's a reason to tell people about it. Mm. There was a point I was going to make. I can't remember. I've lost my train of thought. We'll come back to me. But I think the exerciser pill has been touted around. I think to some extent the exercise oncology field hasn't helped themselves, because there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of very small low quality studies, and as a field we need to get together and produce, and they're happening, the high quality randomized trials. But I think the other thing is it's a lot of healthcare professionals don't include exercise in their lives, and that's the nice thing about 5K Your Way. Once they come down and they see what it's about, and they see that it's not a running race, because my biggest barrier when I'm talking to people about it is that they think, well, of course you like running, you're a running professional triathlete. Getting across to them that it's not 5K Your Way or any, exercise is not doing a running race. There are so many different other ways to be active.
Yeah, so that's the kind of question I want to ask now, of like, what are the challenges you see in your patients before they start exercising? What are the barriers that they have? And what's the best way, what other ways for people to start? How can those challenges be overcome?
So we've a friend of mine who's a triathlete, but he's just had chemo for testicular cancer, and he's about 50, I think. He is 50. He's just turned 50. But he, when he was having his chemo, he's in for three lots of 5 days in hospital to get it. So he bought a spinning bike and he left it on the balcony. And he used it when he was having his treatment.
In hospital,
yeah. So he was in for 5 days every 3 weeks.
That's incredible.
And since he's left it there, other patients have just been using it. So we're now, he's now fundraising to get some extra equipment out there on there. We've got this beautiful roof terrace. But I think it's really hard. So the people that are sporty, if you tell them that they can exercise, they will always find a way, as you've shown, as my friend has shown, as I'm sure I would show if I were ever in that situation. I think for people who aren't sporty, particularly people who are having, so thinking of some of the treatments that I use, you might be having chemotherapy for 6 months, then have massive surgery, perhaps some radiotherapy, then some more chemotherapy. It's really important that we early on advocate movement and maybe not exercise per se, but being active, because otherwise it's all too easy to just sit there and play PlayStation for 6 months.
Yeah, and I guess how, you know, if patients who haven't come from a background of exercise, and this is a conversation I had with the Teenage Cancer Trust in Cambridge, they were saying, you know, just how difficult it was for people who don't come from a background of exercise to start exercising. Have you had any success? You know, and how, and if there has been success, you know, what did you do to sort of help them into this, into a new pattern, a new lifestyle, I suppose, in part?
I mean, it's hard. I think it's really hard to incorporate changes when someone's embarking on treatment like that. And I guess I should just, you know, most people listening won't be cancer experts. Most cancer treatment is not like that. Most cancer treatment is far more manageable. And that's, you know, that what I just mentioned is an extreme. So I guess for a lot of people with cancer, they might have maybe 6 months of treatment, and then hopefully they will, depending on the aims of their treatment, but they will go back to a normal life. And that's when they have, there is this enormous teachable moment. And we talk there, you know, it's well known when someone, actually when someone thinks they've got cancer but they don't, that can stimulate enormous life shifts in how they live their life. And right, maybe coronavirus is in effect a cancer for the whole world, and it's stimulating that change.
It's been uprooting norms, hasn't it?
Say again.
It's been uprooting norms.
Yeah, and it's making everyone evaluate what they want for life. Mm. In the same way that finding a breast lump that isn't cancer, for a little bit of time you think you've got breast cancer, that can stimulate enormous changes and make people, you know, so often people say, and it's, you know, I've changed. I've realised I don't like my job. I don't want to do this PhD. I don't like my husband. I want to spend more time with my kids. I want to go running. You know, whatever you want. I want to learn the piano. I want to.
Yeah.
They stimulate that. So I think that's quite easy to stimulate changes. And there are, you know, there are lots of. You went to the care program.
Yes.
In Nottingham, which does exercise classes for people living with and after cancer, and that, you know, a lot of people who join the care program, so Lizzie you met, I think she does, yes, a lot more exercise now after, yeah, her diagnosis. Robin, all, yeah, of those people do a lot more
and
after.
Such a range of ages as well, that struck me. It wasn't just sort of, you know, fit young things, it was everyone from probably 20 to 75 or something.
Yeah, think. And I guess that, you know, I was really surprised when I saw what the care program did, because I couldn't understand how such a diverse age demographic and educational, but, you know, everything demographic could work, particularly in an exercise class. Like, how could I go and do exercise with a 70-year-old on chemotherapy? But it works. It does work. And the friendships, you've seen the friendships that come out of that and from 5K Your Way. So that works really well after cancer treatment or for people on treatment. I think I still don't know how to do it for people who are having long-term chemotherapy. And I, you know, I've blown in blazing at the start, and that's completely inappropriate for a lot of patients because they're going through so much in the head. The last time they want is some hyperactive oncologist telling them, oh, and by the way, you've really got to stay fit during this as well.
Yeah. Just something else for, like, you to feel rubbish about when you don't achieve it.
Yeah, I mean, can you know, you say, so these are the side effects, la la la, can't sign your consent form. Oh, and by the way, you've really got to stay active because it's going to make you feel better. Whoa, you know, there are.
Yeah.
I don't know where the right time is, and it differs for everybody, I'm sure.
Yes. Yeah. Tell us a bit more about the 5K Your Way, because that has been perhaps your. The way that you've seen an opportunity. I love this whole, like, you know, framing a challenge is, you know, where's the challenge? Where's the opportunity in the challenge? But, like, you've, what could be a challenge that seems kind of too difficult to take on and, you know, to try and get people more active, you've said, actually, I, with an amazing team, can do something about this.
Yeah, so 5K Your Way. Oh, I'm so passionate about this, and probably probably more proud of it than all my Ironman wins. It was actually one patient who gave me the idea, and he was a young man. I hadn't been involved in his care. It was when I was a registrar about 2 and 3 years ago, maybe. But he'd finished his treatment. He'd been theoretically and hopefully cured of his cancer, but he'd lost everything in that process. He'd put on huge amounts of weight. He'd lost his friends. He'd lost his job. And I was just so struck. And I hadn't been involved in him. I just met him once or twice and spoke to the guy that was treating him. And I just thought, we've got to do something. We can't just cure people and then just leave them, you know, with nothing. And I love park run. And I think it's, you know, it's just, you can't yeah. be sad after a park run.
Such a brilliant event.
And so I had this idea, why don't we try and get a group of patients once every 3 months down to park run, and kind of mention it to the nurses. And they were like, no, it won't work. No one will do it. And then I heard about Move Charity. And Gemma, I know you're going to talk to Gemma, and she'll hate me for saying this, but I'd actually emailed Gemma about 6 months before a couple of times and never had a reply. But I mentioned I'm resistant. So, yeah, I'd heard about Move Charity. So anyway, long story short, Gemma and I had a chat. We realised that we had a lot in common, and that we were... So Gemma's an amazing person, and you're going to interview her, or maybe you have done.
Not yet, but I'm really looking forward to sharing that with everyone listening. Gemma, who set up Move.
Yeah, so you can hear about... I'll let Gemma... But she's an incredible person, and we met, and we kind of... I said, I've got this idea about a park run. And she's like, well, that sounds a great idea. So we were both kind of...
Just the sort of person you need, right?
Yeah. And we were both like, well, let's just try it. If no one comes, no one comes. What? And that goes back to kind of learning not to fear failure, which is, I wouldn't have done it without triathlon, because I would have always thought it probably won't work. You know, maybe a bit like you might with this podcast. Maybe no one will listen. So what?
Yeah.
We've had nice chats.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter, does it?
As long as we're enjoying this conversation, and thanks for putting up with me, so.
anyway, that was an aside. So we thought we'll try it in June, and try it once in Nottingham, and just kind of put up some little posters around the hospital, and we got so many people the first, maybe 70 people or something, a lot of supporters.
70.
It was just such an uplifting Saturday morning that we thought we'll do it the last Saturday of every month. And then through the power of social media, which I know does a lot of harm, but also does a huge amount of good, people, I guess a little bit because of my triathlon platform, people heard about it, and a friend in Cambridge started a group in the October, and then I think we had 8 in the January 2019, and then 16 in February, and 24 in March. And then all of a sudden, Gemma and I were like, oh my God, we've actually got a thing, and we don't have anyone to, like, we're just...
Yeah, that was like doubling and doubling. Yeah,
and with hindsight, it grew far too quickly. It was literally just Gemma, who's employed by Move, you know, who's CEO of Move Charity, and me doing it in my spare time. And it wasn't, it probably did grow too quickly. But at the same time, you grow, you become a name, you become a brand, and that gives you more potential to grow. So it's really simple. I haven't even said what it is, but it's just it's just an initiative to encourage anyone affected by cancer. So not just patients, their families, their kids, whether they've got cancer at the moment or they've had cancer, and the healthcare professionals working in cancer services. And I think that's quite a big part of it as well. To come down to park runs the last Saturday of every month, walk, jog, run, cheer or volunteer, and then go for a coffee afterwards.
And I think that probably makes the medical professionals seem a bit more human. Just returning to this, I'm trying to think of my consultant, and I felt like I could operate, you know, with a good background in science, operate on a similar level to him. But I feel like if you can see your consultant in, like, you know, sweating and running gear, then, like, they're just another human being at that point, which then just makes it that much easier to have conversations, like very frank conversations, like, because you're not trying to, there are less pretenses, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think it goes both ways, because I've learned a lot from the people that come who aren't my patients, so I don't treat them, but I hear the other side of being someone who's been affected by cancer, mm-hmm. and that's taught me low. And I hear the other side of the hospital, you know, what bits annoy them and what bits they're grateful, and it's not what you think. I have definitely become a better doctor by hearing that side of things. So it can go both ways, I think.
Yeah, I have to say, the final weekend of January when I started cycling from Bristol to Beijing via the UK, went to the home of the 5K Your Way Park Run, and the vibe, the positivity, the atmosphere was it was so uplifting. It was so exciting. One of the things that I'm hoping with the cycle ride is to try and rewrite the narrative of what's possible with cancer. But that's what 5K Your Way does as well, I feel, from my perspective, that right now we're not in a world where people say, oh, if you've got cancer, you can go out running and, do a 5K, whether that's walking or jogging or running. But you see this community of people who are doing it, and it's exceptional right now, but it always doesn't seem exceptional because everyone's just chatting and they're having coffee, and yet they're actually bucking the narrative of what perhaps sadly right now is common amongst cancer patients.
Yeah, and I think what struck me was that support groups are generally sitting in a room with crap coffee and crap digestive biscuits and 5K Your Way, people don't just go and sit and talk about their cancer. They do sometimes. Mm-hmm. They know that they can do. They get friendships. They develop friendships so that they can have those conversations. But I think one of the biggest things is they know that everyone there gets it. You met Sue, didn't you? The incredible Sue who came on the back of your tandem. And she,
I would love to have her on this.
Why don't you ask her? I'm sure she'd love to. She's coming on our Facebook Live next week, actually. But she is the most incredible lady, and some of the stuff that comes out of her mouth, she has no idea how much it means to me. But just because she sums up what we wanted to achieve with 5K Your Way, and if she was the only person that was helping, then I'd still be happy, and I wouldn't resent any of the Saturdays I've spent kind of going through spreadsheets and answering emails or whatever. She was not a runner. She's in her 70s. She was diagnosed with bowel cancer. She was in a hospital. She tells the story of how, and she's not exaggerating, how she couldn't even get out of bed to go to the toilet. And she saw the flyer and she said, I'm going to do that when I get out of here. And she turned up and she started by walking, and then she started walking and running, and now she runs. And one of the most moving things she said was she feels it gives her something positive once a month to work towards, and that isn't because cancer's so, her life is, she's on treatment and it revolves from treatment to scan, and having something positive to work towards is that gives her a focus. And I think she's back on treatment, on a different treatment now, which I think from the sounds of it, it's tough, but she's still going out running. And she said she feels that it can't be killing her if she's still going out running. And whether or not that's right or wrong, it doesn't, if that's what she feels, and she's just amazing. She's such an inspirational lady. And there are so many Sues out there who don't know that they can live. And I guess it goes back to your can live. And that, I think, that's why when I heard about you and what you wanted to do, it just was exactly what we were trying to achieve with 5K, to find an avenue for people to live their lives actively despite a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, a lot of control is taken away when it feels like so much control is taken away when you get a cancer diagnosis, and there is, but there are still things that each individual can do to make their life a bit better, and that might not be even running 5K or walking 5K, but There are going to be things, you know, maybe it's setting yourself the challenge of walking up the stairs, or getting out of bed, or listening to an audiobook rather than just watching mindless rubbish on the TV, because that's going to make a positive impact in your life. That's what CanLive is all about, really. But it's so similar in ethos to...
And I think the point I was going to make that I forgot has just come back to me. So when I do these talks, what it really frustrates me that you Google complementary therapies, so something that can be used alongside treatments, and you'll find acupuncture and Reiki and God knows what, all this stuff with zero evidence. And exercise has got so much more evidence than anything. Yeah. It's not listed on Cancer Research UK. It's not listed on McMillan. Wow. It's not listed anywhere. And I think we have to change that, because we owe it to patients to at least bring it up and say it's going to make you feel better. And actually, we think it's probably going to make you manage your treatment and potentially slow your cancer as well.
Yes. I think that's one of the biggest challenges, or most important and biggest challenges, in the cancer, public health cancer space this decade, and hopefully it won't be next decade as well, but seeing that shift into what is the default that a consultant will offer, Cancer Research UK considers effective.
And I think so one of the things that healthcare professionals say about why they struggle to talk about exercise is partly because they didn't do it themselves, but also if there aren't places to signpost patients to. And the reason 5K Your Way works is because we are just jumping on the back of the best public health initiative the UK's ever, the world's ever seen, part of that. And we're lucky that Tom Williams, the CRO, and Chrissy Wellington are very supportive of us. But, it doesn't have to be running. It could be, and there are some cool CrossFit groups for people living with an after cancer. I think just any kind of active, so all the care program that provides active, so you're getting the physical benefits from exercise with the psychological benefits of a peer support network, and there aren't enough of those.
Absolutely, and I mean like Trekstock as well, CanLive as people with cancer. And I should make the full disclosure that both 5K Your Way and Trekstock are charities that Bristol Beijing are delighted to support, but that's absolutely out in the open. We've already had such an interesting chat, Lucy. But before we finish, I want to just ask a little bit about COVID, because it is so topical. We had a conversation when I was still in Central Europe before I came back, and you said you were really... can you remember the word you used? It was more than nervous. I think you said you were scared about what could happen. How has it been for you as a doctor? What have the challenges been, both to you kind of being able to support your patients, perhaps with the challenges there, and then also how have you managed to maintain your own sanity or take the best out of the situation?
It's been nowhere near as bad as I thought it was going to be. So I think I was on annual leave, and I was imagining the worst. And it's very easy, isn't it, when you're reading the newspapers and you're watching the news every 2 hours. And my biggest fear as an oncologist was that the hospitals would be flooded. We wouldn't be able to treat patients. I think Nottingham is very lucky where I work. So we are still treating patients. Normally we've got full capacity. All the decisions that we're making about treatments are based on what's right for the patient. In terms of the risk is probably altered because of COVID, but not because we don't have capacity to treat patients. So that fear was, touch wood, false, didn't come to fruition. Challenges. Well, I'm working full time at the moment, which again, wow. I think is a blessing, because it's made me realise this is not the way for a sustainable long term oncology career. So I'm grateful that I've had this opportunity, because I think you have to be honest about what is right for you. And for me, 5 days as an oncologist takes too much else out of my life, and I don't think I'm the best oncologist. certainly not in the long run. It's fine in the short term, but it wouldn't be sustainable for me to do this and be a good oncologist. So it's not been as bad as I hoped. I think the hardest thing for me, so we're doing a lot of stuff over the telephone, which is really hard, particularly the difficult conversations. I find having difficult conversations behind a face mask, standing 2 meters away, is really hard. But I think that the hardest thing is putting myself in the place of some of my patients, who, you know, cancer's just a whole lot shitter at the moment. You know, you're not allowed visitors in hospital. As you know all too well, you can't do what you want to do with your lives. People on treatment are having to isolate very carefully. You know, a tough time's made a whole lot tougher, and I find that quite hard to think about.
I was immensely having the support of like family and friends come in and visit me in the ward meant so much, and so to think that's not possible right now makes something which is for, you know, probably nearly everyone, you know, the toughest experience of their life, to make it that much tougher and lonely.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. I can't even bear to think about it. And I also can't bear to think about, and this is, you know, lots of people work, but that people who do only have a few months left to live, who are living it with bloody COVID, stopping them do what they want to do. And that's just so unfair. I have this anger at for them, that they're stuck in this situation. And we've written letters saying, you know, don't stop this person if they're traveling, but right, where can they go? You know, what can they do? Nothing's open. Lots of people would be scared to see them anyway. So that's the bit that I'm finding hardest, is just thinking of what it must be like.
It's so difficult. The one bit in that sentence I kind of was like, you said unfair, and I'm just surprised you used the word fair or unfair, because to me, I'm not sure fairness ever comes into anything these days.
I think people deal with cancer, and they do, but to have to deal with it in the current climate is just, that just, like, you know, oh, it just, I just cannot imagine how, you know, you said what do you learn from your patients? Tenacity. And I kind of have learned that people deal with what, you know, the poisons that we give them, and the whatever they're told that they is going to happen to them for however long, and they deal with uncertainty. And but to go through, and cancer takes away so much, it takes away control, but then COVID takes away any little bit of anything that might allow them to have a semblance of normality. And it makes me angry. So God only imagines how angry it makes anyone who's actually going through it and their families.
I guess I have to say, from my own experience, I completely hear what you're saying, and this has got quite weighty. I just now feel that anger is such an unhelpful emotion, because it usually does, I'm not sure when it doesn't, it stops you from then making the most of what you do have right now. And so I don't think I was ever angry that I was diagnosed or my brother died. They were like absolutely shit things to happen, but like, I just don't think it's a helpful attitude, because it doesn't mean that you get more time if you're angry and you rage against the world. Like, the situation is what it is. So, and if you've got 3 months left to live, that is shit. But how are you still going to make the most of that time so it is the best 3 months that you can have within all the constraints that are still there?
And do you know what, Luke? I don't think many of my patients are angry. I think I'm angry on their behalf, and not just their behalf, the behalf of everyone.
That's really.
I guess that's what I, that's, you know, what do I find hard about that current climate is putting myself in the people I work with shoes. And yeah, most of them aren't angry, or don't seem. I know some of them are. I don't know. Who knows? But I think oncology. I think the NHS is adapting. We are making positive changes that, you know, would normally take years to come to fruition, and they're just happening like that, which is great. I don't think phone appointments are the way forward for most things. I think they are for a lot of things. So I'm sure we'll move over to those. But I think there's a huge amount to be said for face-to-face conversations and for getting to know people, as you said, rather than a face over Skype.
Mm. Okay, and maybe to wrap up with,
we need a bit of positivity. We've gone quite deep.
We have gone quite deep, and one of the themes that I'm hoping these podcasts will generally have is one of positivity. And there is so much that you do embodying in positivity, but also, you know, through 5K Your Way, enabling positivity. But tell us about one thing that you're really loving that you haven't done before because of COVID.
So we haven't touched on this, but you brought it up, maybe talking, I think, in your introduction about challenges for retirement from being a professional triathlete.
Right.
And actually, I think COVID is what I needed to help me adjust to being normal. In inverted commas, because who wants to be completely normal? But it's taken away any semblance of training. So I'm still exercising a lot, and I told you off air, I've been loving my cyclocross bike because I feel like I'm working full time, so I only have 2 days off a week now. It's been glorious weather. I need to make the most of it. I need to go back to work refreshed, and going out riding my road bike on the roads I know just didn't seem, you know, with no purpose, not riding with friends, didn't seem that enjoyable. So I thought, well, why am I doing that with my weekend? So I take myself off of my cyclocross bike and I go down bridleways and bits of, you know, within a loop that I would normally do in 3 hours on a road bike, and it takes 5 hours, and you're seeing little tiny backlashes, back paths that you'll never see. And I, you know, I think it's just helping me come off that training treadmill and learning slowly to exercise purely for fun rather than training.
I feel so much context is needed for that last, like, 2 minutes, because they're going to be, you know, I'm not really training anymore. You know, like my usual 3 hour route is taking me 5 hours, you know, I'm easing off, I'm backing away. I think, well, yeah, context is required. I dare not think about what it was before.
But I guess I'm not I'm not doing anything with any metrics. And I think, you know, I'm not swimming, I'm not setting an alarm for 5 o'clock. I feel like COVID is forcing me to become a more normal person, and it's long enough that, which I was really struggling to step away from becoming a professional triathlete.
I did want to.
So that's a gratitude. That's a blessing. And I've grown some vegetables in the garden, which is also quite cool.
Nice. Yeah. Your sound. You could pass for anyone else now. Growing vegetables, going for 5 hour rides.
Yeah.
Striking normality.
Just a little bike ride.
just a wee ride. Yeah. Well, Lucy, it has been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so
much.
Keep up the good work. Keep on, you know, going with those little cycle rides. And maybe I'd love to chat some more in the future. So maybe we can have you back on at some point.
Well, I'm intrigued to see what this podcast turns into. So I will definitely be a listener.
Yeah, I mean, I'm intrigued as well. I have no idea.
That's the best way. The best journeys, you don't really have a destination in mind. I don't think.
Follow your nose, be open to what your heart says.
Yeah, and meet interesting people.
Absolutely. Right, Lucy, thank you so much.
All right, Luke.
Bye.
Bye.